We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boskovich.
But the challenge must be faced squarely. I believe we can overcome it through our own efforts. We must do so. The key is our national power. Take courage from our national pride and traditions, no matter how thorny the road to independence may be. And this is The Pause Button, and I'm your host, Borzoi Boskovich. And joining me this week, I have Adam Smith of Myth of the 20th Century. Hello, Adam.
Hey, Borzoi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I think I've almost, let's see here, Nick's been on here. Yeah, of the current cast, I believe I've now completed the collection of the Myth guys. I think I've gotten every single one of you on an episode now, so excellent. Wow. At last.
Glad to be last, but not least, hopefully.
Yeah, and now, where can, obviously, I think anyone who listens to me is a fan of Myth 20th Century at this point. I've been on your show many times, but where can they find all your guys' stuff? Go ahead and plug it all.
Well, we used to be on YouTube, so don't go there, but other than that, we've got a BitChute channel. You can find everything, though, on myth20c.com, or same thing on Twitter, /myth20c. So that's probably the easiest place.
Yeah. And of course there's theamericansun.com. So that's
right.
I've written a number of times for it.
So that's where we have writing content.
Yeah, absolutely. Check that stuff out. And just a quick bit of housekeeping here as well. I'm wrapping up the last of the donation episodes. It's this one. And then I have Red Riding, which I'm doing with Morgoth after that. And I'm working on scheduling that with him. But in the meantime, if you want to sponsor an episode, just contact me at trsborzoi@protonmail.com, and we'll work something out. I can tell you right now that the payment process is not going to be an easy one. I have a number of different ways to take care of that, but anyways, we'll figure it out, and just float your idea by me. I'll think about it. I may or may not do it, and depending on my enthusiasm for the idea, I will say the more interesting your idea is, the more likely I am to take you up on that offer. And only other thing is, like, you just be prepared for possible long delays. This episode took nearly 6 months to complete, and I apologize to the person who donated for this, but I appreciate your patience on this, and I hope this turns out as well as I think it's going to be. But this is the first kind of like a two-part crossover we're doing right now, because after this we're recording a Myth of the 20th Century podcast about the life and times of Park Chung-hee, a very important leader in South Korea. But today we're talking about, on this show, on The Pause Button, we're talking about a Korean movie that came out in 2003 called Shilmi-do, which is about a historical drama based on a true story, a very peculiar true story of a South Korean black ops unit that was trained to assassinate Kim Il-sung. And it was a very interesting movie, very fascinating. But I'll just kick it to you, Adam. I generally ask people when they first come on kind of like the general thoughts about the movie, just again, if set the stage for things.
Yeah, it was good. I have only seen probably, I don't know, a handful of Korean movies, so getting a feel for what the norm of how they tell stories is something I'm really not familiar with yet, to be honest. But obviously it's a historical drama based on a true story. I don't think it's completely accurate based on what supposedly happened, at least officially. They might have embellished on the ending especially, but I thought it was great. I mean, I generally respect East Asian, Northeast Asian culture in particular, for their honor culture. And I think this movie exemplified that quite a bit with a lot of the notions of what they kept saying, the word loyalty throughout the whole movie, but loyalty to whom? And so that was one of the questions I had. And I don't want to give you a plot summary, but that was sort of my initial reaction.
Well, before we get into kind of the plot summary of that, normally I try to avoid doing like a beat by beat kind of thing, but considering that this is going to be a movie, I don't think a lot of people are going to like rush out to see it actually will, and especially because it's based on historical events. To my research, the broad strokes of it are accurate. The details are all inferences, because if you try to research this, you're going to discover like there's almost no information about this. The South Korean government didn't even acknowledge this incident until 3 years after this movie was made. The whole situation is a very weird thing, and I'm going to get into that a little bit later. But as far as Korean films go, now I know our friend Nick Mason is much more of a Korean film aficionado than you and I are, but I spent some time in Korea, and one of my favorite things to do was I would occasionally go to the, even though my Korean language skills have never been great, I had enough to kind of get by on very basic conversational Korean, just enough to, you know, I could last maybe about 5 minutes before I start running out of things to say. But despite that, I liked going to films. Now, going to films in Korea, you can see Hollywood movies there very easily, because generally, unless they're animated, in which case they dub over those. If they're not animated, they just subtitle them, so you can go see English language movies there very easily. But I'd go and see Korean language films, and just because I wanted the experience of seeing Korean films, even though I couldn't understand what was going on. So it kind of became this game of trying to piece together, what exactly am I watching here? And it became much more of a visual experiment for me. And in fact, it was actually always amusing when I had to buy a ticket and the Koreans working there would look at my ticket and look at me and make sure, like, are you sure that this is what you want to see? Like, you understand this is not in English and we don't have English subtitles, right? But this is pretty standard in terms of themes and on historical drama, in terms of the way that they present it in the language of Korean film, because Korean film is having quite a bit of a renaissance. It started with Old Boy in 2000, actually about the same time period, 2003, where you have these much more artistic filmmakers, and it's obviously like reached its apotheosis now with the Parasite winning the Best Picture Award at the Academy Awards. But Korean film has been it's been developing this strong reputation over the last, about 15 years now. It's been going quite strong. But in terms of historical drama, this is actually pretty standard fare, and which is why I wasn't sure if there was going to be much to talk about with this, because strictly speaking, it has a few very basic themes of loyalty, childhood, the idea of what does a man fight for, the idea, you know, kind of a band of brothers theme as well. But there, plot wise, there isn't a whole lot, because there isn't enough for them to draw off of. So in terms of historical drama, it's about standard Korean fare. There's actually been a couple of other Korean movies that came out around this time. Taeguki, which was, I believe that one's about the Korean War. And then there was actually
that's the name of their flag, I believe.
Yep. And then around 2010, 2011, there was a movie. It was a peculiar movie called My Way, which was also loosely based off of historical events. There was when the Allies stormed the beaches at Normandy, they actually found a couple of Korean soldiers there. And it's because of this very strange, convoluted chain of events where Koreans who had been fighting in the Japanese army were caught by Russian soldiers who were put onto, who got moved over at some point to the Western Front, got captured by Germans, and ended up getting stationed at Normandy. It was a very strange set of peculiar circumstances.
Wow.
But there's a common theme of melodrama in a lot of those historical movies, which is why it kind of I don't know. Like, it's hard to describe if you've never seen a Korean film. They have a higher threshold for melodrama for the most part, which I was expecting from Shil Mi Do, but they did a good job of being restrained. And I don't know if that was the sense you got out of it. They tried to keep that under the surface as much as possible, which is a little bit more subtle than what they usually do.
Yeah, I just don't have a baseline, unfortunately, for what to expect. So, I mean, it compares to, I guess, the last one I saw before this. I don't remember what it was called, but it was about kind of a little bit before that, during the Japanese occupation. And it was, it was pretty heavy on the drama. It was a little bit, I don't know. It was a little bit less campy or cheesy. I think the ending of this movie was, I don't know, where they're I probably shouldn't give it away. I don't know, what's your format? Well, here,
do whatever you want, just talk about whatever you want. And trust me, I don't think anyone's gonna go, what do you even remember what the movie was called?
No. Oh, no. I was just about to talk about Shimil Do.
Oh, we're going to spoil. I mean, like, we're going to spoil. We have to, because I want to talk about the historical circumstances of this, so we're going to have to talk about the whole thing. Well, actually, the thing is that we don't know what exactly was said, because, like, this is pieced together from witness accounts, but most of those guys died at the end of this. They were either shot by the army, or they were, or they committed suicide. Only four of them survived and lived to see trial, and they were tried and executed for the mutiny. Yeah. But the details are what are embellished, but in broad strokes, that is what happened. Well, let's actually talk about what happened, but, like, that is what happened. So the context of this is, basically in 1968, there's an attempt on the current president of South Korea, Park Chung-hee, by North Korean commandos who were dressed up as Republic of Korea soldiers. And they were stopped just outside the Blue House, which is the Korean version of the White House. It's the presidential residence. They were stopped, and in retaliation, Park Chung-hee creates a black ops unit that's going to go into North Korea and assassinate Kim Il-sung. They go through an intense training over 3 years. The mission ends up being called off. And then, this is the historical record, a mutiny occurs where they kill their commanding officers, hijack a bus going to Seoul, and then they're stopped by the army, which results in them being shot, them committing suicide, and four of them being captured. And that's basically all we know about Unit 684. That's about the extent of the historical record. South Korea did not acknowledge this until 2006. So this was an incident that was shrouded in secrecy for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think the movie is bending too much of the truth. I think they're trying to make a good story, which I completely understand. I just, one thing that bothered me was when I looked into the actual Wikipedia page on this, it showed a picture of the bus that they had hijacked at the end, where they had surrounded it and the military at that point, because the police officers were trying to intercept it before and they weren't successful, but they had it completely surrounded, and the officers and soldiers were just kind of walking nonchalantly around. And I'm assuming this is the aftermath of capturing all those guys, and the bus looked largely intact. The movie, however, shows them basically taking all their grenades and blowing the entire thing into a giant ball of shrapnel, which would obviously not result in some intact bus at the end. So that sort of kind of threw me for a curve the movie also didn't show that any of them were captured. But overall, it was interesting. I think the movie's also trying to explain or speculate as to what drove these guys to do this. And I don't think that is officially known. It may be known by some people, but it's not officially acknowledged to have any clear reason. I think they kind of intentionally leave it vague, because if one of the theories or several of the theories are proven to be accurate, I think it would paint the government in a pretty negative light, in the government's view at least. So I think that's why they try to keep it vague and somewhat secret.
The main quote you'll find on this, when you because that's the question that always, because that's the, that was the weirdest thing when I was researching this, because I expected to find more historical information about this. I didn't realize how much of a secret this whole thing was, and that's kind of what leads it to a lot of speculation of what exactly happened. There was a military official who was aware of the whole thing, and I didn't provide proper context for this as well, because I just said that they created a unit. I didn't say explain who that unit was composed of. They recruited 31 civilians who were just petty thugs and criminals, street gang guys that they basically sweeped off the street. They were going to be charged with other crimes, and they put them in this unit instead, and then put them through this 3 years of grueling black ops training, just complete civilians for this whole operation. And then this mutiny occurs, and a military official who is familiar with the operation, and you'll see this often quoted if you look up Unit 684 at all, what he had to say about it was they revolted because they felt they were never going to get the chance to go to North Korea, and that was after the mission was canceled, and that they would never be allowed to leave the island. They were in despair, which doesn't, again, leads a lot to speculation.
Yeah, and the movie obviously goes way over the top on that plus some. I mean, they go so far as to say that the government's trying to murder them because they didn't want to have any trace of this, you can call it a human rights violation, or also they didn't want the North Korean government to know that this plot was being planned and then scuttled later. So those are, I guess, the two reasons they would do that. But the official account doesn't indicate that that was attempted at all. So I don't know if that's embellishment or that's a conspiracy theory that is held by some in Korea, but or it was just thrown into the movie for dramatic effect. I don't know.
It's very difficult to ascertain on a lot of this, a lot of the stuff. And to just kind of give a little bit more historical context for this, when the Unit 684 was created, they kind of called this like a mini Second Korean War, because in 1968 things were heating up again. Now the Korean, for people who aren't aware, the Korean War has never officially ended. It's never actually ended, which is why every couple of years you'll hear about little skirmishes that occur between the North and the South, where they shoot across each other. You know, they shoot each other across the water border or across the DMZ or the like. And it's just because there's been no official peace on this. Well, in 1968, things really started to heat up. It wasn't just that you had the Blue House raid. You also had the capture of the USS Pueblo, and you had the North Koreans working their way towards invading the South again. And this is actually something you can visit if you ever go to South Korea and you visit the DMZ. You can find a number of tunnels that were found that were dug by the North Koreans in preparation for an invasion back into South Korea. They were going to send troops under the DMZ into South Korea. And this was heating up during the Johnson administration. And it wasn't, but during Nixon's tenure, once the Nixon shock occurred and the Guam Doctrine was in effect, which is what started to shift everything. That's where we got, like, that was building the groundwork for a detente in the Sino-Soviet split and Nixon going to China. This was all, that stuff was being, the ground was being built on this. And if people don't know what the Guam Doctrine is, that's basically where Nixon told them, like, we are not going to be fighting for the defense of every single free country in the world. Like, some of you guys are on your own. And that was the point where Park Chung-hee really kind of realized, he was going through a lot of the time as well, because he had committed all these troops to Vietnam, and in 1971, which is when the mutiny occurs, he was in a close re-election bid against his rival, Kim Dae-jung, and he really kind of needed to shift his policy. He couldn't go with this aggressive policy, especially since the United States was trying to pull back tensions anyway. So after this hot period when they're training this black ops unit, now he's got to put the stops on this. The mission is canceled. And so after making these and trying to make these gestures of friendship towards North Korea, if a unit were to be discovered that was the whole plan was to assassinate Kim Il Sung, that would have caused a lot of problems, especially because this is right before the Yushin Constitution is instituted. Park Chung-hee's position was a bit tenuous at this moment, so the saving face was a very important at this time. Not to mention, there really wasn't any certainty. They really didn't seem to know what to do with these guys. But now we're kind of getting into the speculation territory because they just will not talk about this. So little is known about this now, and it lends itself to an interesting story, though, which is, I guess, the context of this movie, because we follow what we end up. I guess we can talk about it properly now. We follow the lives of these men during their time in this boot camp. Our main focus is a guy named Gang In-chan, who his character motivation is that his father left the family because he was a suspected North Korean spy, had been arrested on that. He escaped and fled to North Korea. And this is a driving motivation for him throughout the entire movie, where he embraces this mission to assassinate Kim Il Sung because he wants a chance to find his father and kill him as well. But he gets arrested after engaging in petty street violence, attacking the head of another crime family, and we follow their lives through this until that mutiny in 1971.
I was just watching it in the beginning part and wondering if this was going to be kind of the Korean Full Metal Jacket. So it was very much like this intense boot camp experience, and the recruits were not volunteers; they were conscripts. I don't know if you technically could call a prisoner put into something like this a conscript, but they were not there through their own will. However, they did seem to prefer it, oddly, to prison, which never really made too much sense because the rigors of the boot camp were such that at least one of the guys died during the training.
Yeah, historically, and seven died.
Yeah, and the training sequences were pretty good. I enjoyed watching them. The brutality of it, I don't know. I'm sure the Koreans like to think of themselves as the toughest people in the world, and they're not wimps, but I don't know. I didn't see anything that ridiculous. I can't imagine the Russians are any nicer. I don't know what your thoughts were, but it was
Koreans
impressive, but go ahead.
Tend to have an inflated sense of self in my personal experience.
I'm very well aware of that. But we talked about the flag briefly, but I mean it means like the Korean like race. I mean it's a very nationalistic country. So
yeah, the term for it is the Minjok. That's one of the reasons why I think that you had this rapprochement between the North and the South briefly, because the funny thing is, like, if you look, and we're going to talk about this in Myth of the 20th Century, Park Chung-hee focused so heavily on self-reliance among the Korean people, among the South Korean people. And he had
previously... So the North, the Juche.
Juche literally means self-reliance. That's literally what the term means. And
do they use that term in the South, though? I mean, the concept, I know they do, but do they use that same term as the Northerners?
Like the term Juche?
Yeah. I've only heard that in the Northern context.
That's a good question. I don't know exactly if the...
Cause it just seemed politically they probably wouldn't, but
they
come
probably
up
wouldn't. Similar, but, you know? Well, and this is actually why there's always been a very strong desire between the Korean people to unify. Now, it's not one of those things where it's like people, because I they're kind of aware of the situation and people have their own lives to live. It's not like they're going to be out there protesting every day to rejoin the Koreans. But the term Minjok, you know, it's like, you know, our nation, our blood, is very strong among Koreans, even if it's not something if Koreans don't talk about explicitly, they tend to feel it very implicitly. They do see North Koreans as the brothers. It seems to be among white you know, white people, European stock people, that we put a lot more stock into ideology than other peoples do. And you see this constantly when people try to define these Asian strongmen. At times, it's less that they're ideological, it's more that they're just rivals for power in terms of how it ends up shaking out. Now, it's, you know, there was a different approach to international relationships and in industry between the North and the South, but it's the differences are differences of time now more than just anything else because of how closed off the North Koreans have been. But you do find very similar sentiments. You'll find very strong sentiments among South Koreans towards just like, you know, we are brothers. This is our peninsula. We are one people, regardless of this thing. It's just they see it as kind of like it's just circumstantial that the two countries are divided, which is why you had in 2000s this push towards the Sunshine Policy of trying to cool off relationships between the two better.
Well, given how long Asians, it seems like Chinese and Koreans are probably worse than the Japanese at this. I don't know, but how long they hold grudges and how long they hold positions and stubbornly stick to them. I don't know how those Sunshine Policies actually were conducted, just what were the terms of discussion even? Because from a European or Westerner standpoint, it probably would be very different. And that, look, guys, you know, can we just set this aside? This is getting ridiculous. I don't think that sort of language would be used. It seems like throughout the movie, and also from my understanding of watching the Northerners and Southerners, is that both sides think that they're right and their role is to liberate the other side.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you overcome those. They baked it into their, I don't know if their constitution, but at least their culture and their political systems, such that they have this ideological opposition out there. And given this notion of saving face, I don't know how they could actually wind that back. I'm sure people have worked on this, and in an Asian thinking way, there's some way to come up with something that is very oblique and lets everybody look good in the end, but I don't know actually how that would work out. That was one of the things they said at the beginning of the movie, like, we're coming down to liberate our South Korean brothers. And I've actually talked to Korean Americans about this, and they're obviously from the South. I mean, maybe that's not obvious, but I think the vast majority of Korean Americans are from the South. And they weren't as sanguine on the Northerners. They seemed to, they didn't have this like lovey-dovey feeling. And these are younger guys, by the way. They didn't have this great feeling about letting the Northerners into the South at this point.
Yeah, I should clarify a little bit, because I didn't do a good job of explaining that. For Koreans, it's a very their love of the nation of the race is a very abstract thing, because they've had issues with North Koreans coming into South Korea, the defectors, and defectors have always had an issue assimilating kind of into the new South Korean culture. There are very real differences. It's this very weird phenomenon where it's not that weird, but it's like, you know, like the idea, they love the idea of it, but it's when you get to the implementation stage and you start actually confronting with reality that's when it really starts to break down. And because to overcome those challenges would probably require a lot more give and take than the respective parties are willing to give up. That's where things end up stalling. But it's one of those. I guess it's not as unusual as I would as I kind of put it to be, because I mean, like, we see this constantly in politics. Like, well, we all love the idea of something, but then when it comes to the actual reality of it, it's like, well, maybe I don't love the idea as much as I thought I did.
Well, everybody likes the upside. They just don't like paying for it.
Yeah.
And in the South's case, they would be paying a lot. And the North, the problem is the ruling family would lose power. And so, you know, what are the incentives? I mean, you know, the incentives are for the poor people in North Korea to leave. but the incentives for the ruling class up there is to keep them there and to shoot them if they try. So I don't know. I don't know how this gets fixed. I mean, maybe they get coronavirus or something. I shouldn't laugh, but yeah, this is getting weird with this movie parasite and all this disease spreading.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's not surprising to me that a movie like Parasite was would have been made by a Zopkrenner, because class issues of the Korean society is just very kind of it can be very strange at times for an outsider, just because it's the way that they industrialized very quickly. You see like these all you see this major clash of the of kind of this new world modernism, but also trying to incorporate tradition into that, and trying to keep the sense of Koreanness, which is why they tend like you'll if you've ever you said you've talked to Korean Americans. I mean, like you see this carry over as well to when they become immigrants to other countries, where talking up about the accomplishments, the historical accomplishments of Korea and the contemporary accomplishments of Korea is a huge deal to them. I remember the Virginia Tech shooting that was done by a Korean, and Koreans took that as a mark of national shame, because he was a representative, you know, despite the fact that we have God, millions of Koreans probably in this country. And for the most part, Americans aren't going to see that as like, well, that's not like a representative of who the Korean people are, but they treated that as such. There was this deep soul searching among Koreans when the Virginia Tech shooting happened. And so they'll do the reverse and the converse on that as well with in terms of accomplishments. Like failures and successes are both taken hand in hand by them, and they're like kind of taken to their most logical extremes at times.
So that would indicate a very nationalistic ethos. And in my studies of the history of the Park Chung-hee era, it was made somewhat clear to me that he was actually trying to inculcate that more so into the Korean people, which he felt were not nationalistic enough, because they, in his view, were too Confucianistic. Mm-hmm. In other words, they were too family oriented, and that would place the loyalty to the family over the nation, for example. And I don't know how much of what we're seeing today with this nationalistic feeling of individual achievement or failure and association with that to the individual level, even if you're not directly involved. I don't know how much of that was inculcated because of people like Park, or if it's just a historical thing of the Korean people. I don't know if that's true in other Asian countries. I mean, obviously there is some of that in every country to a certain degree, but I'm trying to compare them right now. Yeah, go ahead.
In terms of the Confucianism, Korea has always been like this has been stated to me several times by Koreans and by people who understand Koreans, is that Koreans are even more Confucianist than the Chinese are. Like they took Confucianism much harder than the Chinese did, probably because China, being such a much larger and diverse country, has so many different traditions to draw off of, that, you know, and it's got such a long history that like different things come and go and come into fashion, and like all that informs Chinese culture and all that informs Chinese history and informs who they are. But they are drawing off so many different traditions, whereas in Korea, like they really, really embrace Confucianism, and it still informs them to this day. And you're absolutely right, the Park Chung-hee was trying to find a way to get them away from that Confucianism, but he knew they would never be able to truly get rid of it. So he was trying to find a way to synthesize it into the Korean way. And you can actually see themes of that in this movie. There are some actually the most interesting aspects of this movie to me were the much more subtle themes of it, because there's this deep sense of the idea of killing the father and this deep sense of lost childhood, because you have that juxtaposition in the beginning where you have the North Korean commandos pretending to be South Koreans and trying to assassinate Park Chung-hee, and that's cut against the, you have Gong Incheon, the character we follow throughout this whole movie, where he tries to assassinate the head of a family. And in both instances, both of those instances fail. You know, and both of these groups are trying to assassinate a father figure, because Park Chung Hee was a father. He's still the most, by plurality, he's still the most popular leader that South Korea has ever had. He is, and he really is, deserves the title of the father of the nation, because he built South Korea. The people who lived through the Park Chung Hee era, even with all the misgivings that some have about him, like, they still thank him. Like, they're still incredibly thankful for the way that he turned South Korea into a first world nation within decades. He managed to do that. And you'll see this weird juxtaposition in the Korean countryside, where you have these old, you still have these old farm communities, but they are slowly removing them one by one. I mean, where he came from, Gumi, is an industrial center now. When he was born, it was just a farm. It was just a farming village. That's all it was. He turned his birthplace, his hometown, into a center of industry in South Korea within his lifetime. So he really is a father of that nation. And so in this movie, you have this idea of the father, but throughout the movie, Park Chung-hee does not appear at all in the movie, though his presence is felt throughout. He's an absent father, just like Gong In-chan's father is an absent father. And so you have this idea of trying to kill the father, which would go strongly against Confucianism. But they contrast that theme with the theme of kind of like this lost childhood. Because there's a very interesting scene, and unless you know kind of the nuance of Korean history, I had to research this just to be absolutely certain I got this right. There's a part when they're having this scene of camaraderie, and you might know what I'm talking about. Remember when they're singing a song to the tune of "Auld Lang Syne"?
Yeah, that was weird.
That's the New Year's song.
I guess people haven't. Well, they have to hear what we're talking about, but yeah, that, and I can't recite the lyrics, but everybody knows. Yes, that's the cadence. Yeah. And I looked up go ahead. I mean, yeah, so I know what you're talking about.
So that was actually for a brief time the melody for the national anthem of South Korea, because the provisional, because Korea was, there was a reason why Pyongyang was called for a while the Jerusalem of the East. The Koreans have historically been the most Christian of all the East Asian countries, I guess maybe outside Philippines. Anyways, but it was a strong Presbyterian Protestant stronghold. It's why so many Koreans were educated at Princeton, why Syngman Rhee was educated at Princeton, because that was a Presbyterian school. But and Auld Lang Syne is a Scottish ballad, and it was the melody of it was adopted as the national anthem of South Korea until that was a band that was dropped in 1948 when the country, because it was more of a provisional government anthem, it was eventually dropped in favor of their own melody. But the lyrics that the soldiers are singing in the movie are the lyrics of the national anthem. In 1971, though, that was not the national melody, but they would have been children in 1948 when they would have heard that song growing up. That's them hearkening back to a more nostalgic, simpler time. That's it. That this is representative of their lost child. These soldiers are lost children, and that's kind of the way that was the most subtle theme in this movie, and that is kind of like the whole theme of it. You have these men who were forced into this, who came from lives of poverty, because poverty becomes another theme in this, where you have the whole incident of the rape and all that. And like, what do they wish for? They want to be reborn as the son of a rich father. You have this theme of boys and men who were born and raised into poverty, who have absent fathers, and they're pressed into service. And now this mission, they're trying to serve and please their own absent father, Park Chung-hee, in this. And they're doing what they were told. They were doing everything that they were taught to do in this service. And so that moment when they're singing to Auld Lang Syne, that's supposed to be like a memory of a more innocent, nostalgic time. That's a lost childhood theme.
Yeah, I didn't think about it that deeply, but that makes sense. And I didn't know, because I was curious about the lyrics, literally, because they're very, not violent, but they're very disturbing to someone who's not, I guess, used to the imagery that it conjures up. And specifically, it was soldiers' corpses are wrapped in a bloody people's flag.
Oh, that's a different song. That's not the Auld Lang Syne song. That's you're talking about the scene where because there's two different songs.
That came up, I thought, a couple times at least.
Well, there's two different songs in the movie. There's the one where they're singing to Auld Lang Syne, and that's the lyrics on that one is the national anthem. Until that day when Mount Baekdu is worn away and the East Sea's waters run dry, may God protect and preserve our country. Okay. The one that you're talking about with the wrapped in soldier, like that's the scene where he's so you have two soldiers who escape the island, and they rape a nurse. They get caught by the military, and they're going to commit suicide. And that's where I was referring to, where they decide, like, they make a vow to it, like they say, like, may you be born the son of a rich man in the next life.
Mm-hmm.
And only one of them successfully gets killed. They capture the other one, and then all the soldiers are being punished for this soldier's transgressions, and he's restrained, and he starts singing. What he's singing is the red flag song of the North Korean soldiers. And he's doing that. This is actually another, like, really subtle.
Oh, that's the North Korean song?
Yeah. Jeez. And this is another subtle thing. Like, I had to research this because I was as confused as you are. And, like, I knew, like, there's some significance to them singing these songs. I recognized the national anthem part. I didn't recognize the other song. So I had to research that. That's a North Korean soldier song. He's doing that deliberately to provoke the main character, Gong In-chan, to kill him. Because remember, his father, like, he would be aware that Gong In-chan's father is an accused North Korean spy who escaped to North Korea and left his son behind. Mm-hmm. So he's deliberately evoking North Korean imagery to provoke Gong into killing him. But yeah, that's a very violent song. It's a North Korean song. I actually have the lyrics right here as well.
Yeah, it fits more to, I think, the origin story of the North Korean regime, because they're very martial. Much of their power stems from their military power. I mean, they have nuclear weapons, and the people have got probably a caloric intake every day of less than 2,000 calories. And so I think it makes sense to be a North Korean.
Yeah. Allegedly, North Koreans are 6 inches shorter than their South Korean cousins.
I've heard they're shorter. I didn't know it was that much. That's a lot.
That's the alleged. I wouldn't be surprised if that's, you know, a bit propagandistic. I'm sure. I'm absolutely certain that they are shorter. But that was what I had read years and years ago. That they are on average 6 inches shorter. I'm sure that's an exaggeration, though.
Have you seen what's the new guy's name? Kim
Jong Un.
There you go. Yeah, I can't keep track anymore.
Big boy.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he actually is probably a better leader than his father, who was kind of a kook. But
I'm actually shocked at the way. So, I used to follow the North Korea situation very closely when I was when I was over there, and because of his youth and he was the son who originally wasn't supposed to succeed. And there was basically nothing known about him. And people had assumed, because he had been Western educated, that he was going, like, that, okay, so this is, like, we're going to see, he's either going to be a puppet or he's going to actually start, like, making gestures to the West. I had been under the, I had assumed he was going to basically be a puppet of his uncle, his aunt's ex-husband.
The one that he killed?
Yes, the one that he fed to dogs. Allegedly.
Oh, I didn't know it was
which is a huge, like, that's a huge dishonor. Like, if that's what actually happened, that's a huge dishonor, because
they normally eat dogs, very dogs. Dirty. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah, it was Kim. It was like oh man, I can't remember his name, but
What was the official bullshit story? Like, he was being disloyal to the great North Korean people or something.
Yeah, and I had assumed that he had a firmer hold because his uncle had all these connections with the Chinese. His uncle was tight with a lot of the general Zhang Song Tech, that was his name. I had assumed, like, I had heard that he was close with a lot of the generals, and you need the support of the generals in South Korea. But I mean, obviously, we have a very incomplete picture of what goes on over there. Kim Jong-un managed to consolidate power as a young man in his 20s. I guess not. I mean, young by political standards. As a young man in his 20s, he managed to consolidate power. He was accused basically of being a counter-revolutionary.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, I think to everybody, as you said, it just looks like it's a power play and trying to consolidate his control over the country, which I guess he did. I mean, the older I get, the more I see how people at the top, I think 2 out of 5 CEOs or sociopaths kind of thing. You could probably say that about Park Chung-hee. I mean, you have to be morally ambiguous to maintain the reins over a large group of people, it would seem. It would just seem to be that's how it works. I don't know of, you know, Jimmy Carter, notwithstanding, although I've heard he's actually not as nice as he portrays himself to be, but I don't know of too many other examples of people getting to the top who are aw shucks types. And I'm not saying I'm one of these psychopaths. I couldn't do it because it would bother me too much to take people out like that. But you have to look at the results of a guy like Park and wonder, you know, what is moral at the end of the day. And I guess that's kind of getting back to the movie. Is it right to do what they're doing to these guys when they're facing a regime that is, you know, trying to kill them? So I don't know if you want to bring it back in that way.
I will read, at the very least, read the lyrics of that violence, of that North Korean song we were talking about. Soldiers' corpses are wrapped in a bloody people's flag. Before the bodies turn cold and stiff, the blood stains the flag red. Raise it to the sky, the red-stained bloody flag, and beneath it make a solemn vow. Cowards can leave if they wish to go. We will remain to protect our flag.
Yeah, when they say the flag, are they talking about the people too? Because I've heard that transliteration, like at least in the South, the symbol, it's a yin and yang in the center of the flag. And that has various meanings, like the balancing of opposites. But I've also heard that it represents the people. Now, the North Korean flag, I vaguely remember there's like a star in there. And it doesn't seem to have kind of the Confucian or Asian symbolism. It's more a communist. But I don't know when they say the North Korean song. I don't know when they say the flag. Are they talking about the people like the South Koreans talk about the people when they talk about their flag?
That's an excellent question. Yeah, I want to double check the flag. Yeah, the flag in North Korea does not contain the Taeguk at all, which is that's the yin yang symbol.
Yeah.
Although it does use their colors, that's why it's got the blue bands.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got they kind of got the blue bands sandwiching. It is the I guess that was their attempt to kind of compromise on having some kind of some representation of the Taeguki or the Taeguk.
Yeah,
I'm unfortunately not extremely knowledgeable about kind of the intricacies of that kind of the North Korean culture on that point. It's in fact actually when I tried to find, it took me a while to actually figure out what that song was because I could tell by the lyrics that was probably a North Korean song because it's referring to the reference to the people the way that it was doing. It's like, okay, that sounds like a North Korean song, but it was actually hard for me to kind of, because like the funny thing is like if you Google some of the things in this movie and the subtitles, it just takes you to a script of this movie. So it took me a couple tries to kind of figure out where that song came from, but it's a North Korean patriotic song, a soldier's song. So if it's for the soldiers specifically, then it's probably just strictly speaking about the flag, I would imagine.
So let's just talk, I don't know, about, well, at least that what I want to talk about, which is the whole concept of having a Black Ops unit that is composed of questionably reliable individuals. I guess that's how I would put it.
Yeah. Like street thugs, because that's what they were.
Yeah, it's like, and I mentioned this before, but the soldiers, when they salute their commanding officers, they say loyalty, whatever that word is in Korean. And can you trust these guys? I don't know what the thinking was here. I guess they probably just didn't want to use guys that were more valuable, for lack of a better way of putting it. They viewed these guys as disposable.
Yeah. I had written a little note on this as well, because there's a reason why I called this whole situation peculiar, because here's a couple, the few facts we do know, we can make, I think, some accurate speculations on this. For one, this was something that Park Chung-hee took extremely personally, because they specifically composed the unit of 31 men, which is the exact same number that came to kill him during the failed Blue House raid. It was 31 North Koreans that were sent to kill Park Chung-hee, so he's sending 31 South Koreans to kill him, to kill Kim Il-sung. And it was... the unit was created by the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, which...
KCIA.
Yeah, KCIA, which would ultimately is what was going to, you know, was going to assassinate Park Chung-hee. But at the time, in 1968, I'm pretty sure it was still under his ally, Kim Jong-pil, who had
Kim
helped
Jong
him.
Pill. Sorry. Kim Jong Il and Kim Jong Pil.
Take the Jong Pil. But I'm pretty sure. Well, so Kim Jong Pil is the one who created the Korean Central Intelligence Agency. He was also Park Chung Hee's right hand man during the coup that brought Park Chung Hee to power in 1961. And Kim Jong-pil was not liked at all by the United States government or by our State Department. They really hated that guy a lot. And Kim Jong-pil was pretty... I was looking to see if he ever turned on Park Chung-hee, but it seems like he was pretty loyal to Park Chung-hee through this period. It's not until you have Kim Jae-gyu being appointed the director of KCIA, and Kim Jae-gyu is the one who assassinated Park Chung-hee. It's not until he's appointed that I think you start to see that turn. So during this time period, you still have this loyalty to Park Chung-hee. So I think we can say that they were working in concert with each other on this. So Park Chung-hee creates Unit 684, and it's obviously something he took personally, as it's composed of the same amount of people. The question becomes like, why? Then why these guys specifically? And I can think of two possible reasons why, and they can work in conjunction with each other. The first being that plausible deniability is like nobody would like who's going to believe that a bunch of street thugs were sent to assassinate Kim Il-sung. Like maybe they believed that it was like this would help them kind of keep things secret, especially because they removed the records on these guys. Like you basically create these people that have no choice but to do this, and you kind of keep things away from military bureaucracy, because this is like kind of a personal project of sorts, it seems. The other reason being, if you want to take this angle that, you know, that kind of like this national theme angle, because I mean, we do know he was personally grieved enough to specifically choose 31 guys, is maybe it's a way to, as poking an eye, putting a finger in the eye of the North Koreans by saying, like, okay, you took your best of the best, and you sent them down here to assassinate me. I'm going to scoop up street thugs and send them over there, and they're going to kill you. Just kind of like a way to, as like, It's a flex, like a flex, basically. Trying to flex on the North Koreans by, instead of sending the best of the best, I'm going to take common street thugs and turn them into assassins and kill your leader.
Yeah, that makes sense. Did the KCIA at least view this as a suicide mission for these guys? I mean, I would view it that way. I don't know how they could get back alive. Yeah, I don't
think there's any expectation of these guys. And that's I think, the other reason why they were kind of pursuing this, is that these men were meant to be disposable. I don't believe they had any intention of having those guys ever come back.
Yeah, I mean, what I found interesting also during the film was just this seeming, and I don't think it's unusual for this in other cultures in the West, and for example, I think it's true as well, but having this cultural contrast between the intelligence services and the military. And I don't remember any of these guys' names, to be honest, but the guy who was the sergeant in charge of the camp, he's kind of your good old boy military type, who seemed to, on one hand, a big part of being in the military is following orders, chain of command, respecting that. But at the same time, he does have this dedication to a certain code of honor that I found, I think the movie also attempts to make this fairly clear, but fairly lacking in the KCIA. And the interactions between the sergeant and his subordinates are telling in how he's very tough. And you could view it as tough love. I mean, you want to prepare these guys, you know, for the worst. And so you can't give them easy assignments. You know, if the homework is not going to be like the test, you're not preparing them, right? So he's doing, I think, his job. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And it's very, I think, morally upright, at least in the short, near-term context of him following. He doesn't have a choice to follow the order of figuring out this mission. So if I have to do this mission, I'm going to do it and make these guys as effective and survivable as possible. And that part, 100% on board with. Where it becomes a gray area is, should I even be following the orders? The tough thing about that is, well, if I disagree with this, well, they'll just replace me with somebody who will do it anyway. And so maybe I should be the guy who can actually do a better job than somebody who's a complete nut job psycho who doesn't give a damn about anybody but himself. There's that conflict, I think, in his head, and you could sort of see how he's basically bordering on the verge of insubordination when he finds out that the KCIA wants him to kill all these guys after spending 3 years with them. And he's like, okay. And the intelligence officer is like, well, look, isn't your first duty as a military officer to obey orders? And he's like, well, I don't remember his exact response to that, but it was fairly clever. And it was like, well, I think, my duties to the people. And then the guy's like, well, you know, I'm in charge of you. And it's like, well, is the intelligence services in charge of the nation? I think that's one of the things he said back to him. And you could kind of make parallels with that in the United States, where the CIA is doing its thing and the military is operating the open and having to play by the rules. Meanwhile, the CIA is doing whatever the F they want and getting their own money through clandestine and illicit means, drugs, you know, for example. And in many ways, they have more power because they do operate in the darkness and without the rule of law governing them. And they're less understood by most people too. So they have that going for them, because they can, there's not as much scrutiny placed on them, and they also manipulate Hollywood and whatnot to give themselves a good image, et cetera. But, for example, like during that era, we don't even have to go very far geographically or, time-wise, the CIA was doing these types of things in Vietnam, these black operations.
South Korea was the second largest country that committed forces after us to that conflict.
Yeah, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I do know that's true, and I think it was
300,000 or something.
No, that can't be right. The American forces, I thought, were somewhere around that number, maybe a little bit more, but that much? That's huge. That's enormous.
It was I know he committed a lot. I mean,
in total, you mean not actively like deployed at a given
yeah.
time.
Yeah, here we go. Okay. Yeah, in total, yes, in total between 65 and 73, 312,000 South Korean soldiers fought in Vietnam.
Yeah,
they killed 41,000 North Vietnamese. Damn, and 5,000 civilians. Wow. Yeah, there's some after My Lai, like there's a and I know what's his name, Matthew Raphael Johnson has talked about this. This massacre, what was it called? I can't remember. After My Lai, there's the second most famous kind of like massacre in the Vietnam War was ostensibly, I'm not going to get into the history of it because I just don't know the history of it because there's like some weird, there's definitely some weirdness about the whole massacre. But yeah, there was a massacre that was, committed by the Koreans that were over there.
Yeah. And, that I totally believe. But I mean, I've always interpreted that very simply is that the South Korean government is trying to do the U.S. a solid so that U.S. doesn't bail on them up in the peninsula. I think that should be pretty obvious to anybody. So I don't think South deserves any huge amount of thanks. I mean, the United States has dumped how many billions and how many soldiers into their stupid peninsula, which is completely useless for an American's point of view. But oh, dude. I mean, I grew up believing in this shit, and it's just like, oh, God. And I see these movies, and it's like, I want to believe that there's like a nation out there that actually gives a damn about its people. And, you know, the people, if they pay their dues, they get rewarded for it. But you see this shit, and it's like, these guys were fed to the dogs. I mean, it was horrible. And
yeah,
I don't know. I guess it's
well, just... Well, that actually leads... And that's one of the reasons why this movie kind of is the way it is, why it's got this theme of there's two quotes that I think define this. One is and I forget who said it, I think this one came from the KCI guy. One must discard the relics of the past age to open a new age, which is a very Park Chung-hee attitude. And then there's a quote later, and I can't remember who said this, but this is a unit made to achieve the nation's aims. If those aims vanish, the nation must take responsibility. That had to have been the sergeant then. Yeah, it was the sergeant who said that. And you have the clash of those two themes. The thing is, I think the thing that's a theme that's especially important for Americans to understand is because we've had this unbroken chain of governance since the nation's creation, in terms of Korea's like on its fifth or sixth republic now. I forget which it is, but they're
wait a minute. We had a civil war. I mean,
in American, call that in Americans, unbroken, in American, but in Americans' minds, we've had an unbroken chain of governance.
Well, Americans are stupid.
This is actually my point. My point I'm making here is, to the American mythos and the consciousness, there's a strong, and this is, I mean, this has been rapidly eroding, and we're experiencing that erosion firsthand. But there has been a rapid erosion of this civic patriotism, where American, and because of our attachment to the Constitution and all of that, we have a much more strong attachment to these abstract notions of civic mindedness that helps inform our Americanism. Koreans don't have that. And so this is a common attitude you'll have where, and this is part of the reason for the conflict, you know, some of the conflicts that are in this movie, is Koreans are very nationalistic, but that nationalism doesn't extend to any kind of civic mindedness in terms of their governance, because they've gone through so many governments in the last 7 years, because they've gone through so many different republics. There are people that are very, very prone to rioting and protesting. It's practically a pastime.
Yeah, maybe we could save that for
myth
show, but I was actually going to ask you about that at some point.
Oh, I guess I have some stuff to say that, and I'll save it. I say about that, and I'll save it for the show. But that's why I refer to the term of the mean joke. Our blood, our nation. These are people who are very blood oriented, and that's why they do have this. They feel like many of them still feel this connection to North Koreans, but it's like it becomes like an abstract thing because there's just too many obstacles that are in the way on that. But they don't like South Koreans are not generally like patriotic towards their government. the way that Americans kind of historically were up until recent memory. They just aren't that way because it's just of the historical circumstances of all that. So they have a sense of themselves, but it's not anything that they feel towards the government, which is why Shilmi Do kind of has this conflict at the, like, it's implicit in it, but it's at the centerpiece of it. It's like, okay, the country has plucked these guys, it's plucked the dregs of their society who never had a chance, and it gave them a mission, it gave them purpose, because that's the theme in this movie. These men finally have a purpose in life, and they follow this absent father to the letter, and they just, you know, they embrace it, they want to do right, and then they're just abandoned. And that's a sense that there's within Korean culture, among contemporary Koreans, there is this often. There's a sense of being abandoned. I forget the term. They call it Hell Joseon. That's what they call Korea right now.
Well, it's the story of Rambo. The guy, he basically is given all this military hardware and training and gets good at it. And then when he's no longer politically correct, he gets tossed into the wilderness, literally. And I just wanted to say, I was mentioning the U.S. government has engaged in black operations. I mean, every government does. I'm not sort of trying to point fingers here necessarily. But in the Vietnam era, as we were mentioning, with the South Koreans were engaged, the Phoenix program was something we have talked about quite a bit in our show. And I have one story where that actually was told by a former black ops operator, Chip Tatum, on numerous interviews he did back in the 90s, in particular with one was Ted Gunderson, is this guy who was sort of exposing that era's Pizzagate, former FBI guy. But he was talking to Chip Tatum, who was drafted like everybody else had to be, unless you were, you know, you had some exception to that. But he was drafted like most people during the Vietnam era, and they put him into a flight academy. And there was a point where he was kind of given the option, do you want to sort of fly planes, or do you want to go in the jungles? And he's like, well, I prefer the air conditioning, so give me the plane. And so they started using him for these various missions, and I think the CIA ultimately got their hooks into him. And he quit, or he was honorably discharged, and then they brought him back, and it was like they sort of showed up with these sunglasses, and it's like, hey man, we need you. And he's like, well, you know, I'm good, thanks. And it's like, that wasn't a request. So he was thrown back into this bullshit. And the mission that was really eye opening for me was that, and this was authorized by Nixon, according to Tatum, was that he was put on a aircraft to go over the border of South Vietnam into one of the neighboring countries. I always mix them up, but it's either Laos or Cambodia, one of the two. One of the countries where the U.S. was not allowed to have any military engagement, to the detriment of the U.S. military's operations, obviously, because the North Koreans, or not North Koreans, North Vietnamese were using that network of trails, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, with impunity to go around the guarded borders of the North and South and go along that huge opening area between the South and Laos and Cambodia. And so officially the U.S. wasn't allowed to go in there. So they had to do this black operation, if you would sort of think just real politic wise. And the goal was to do a false flag against one of the countries there and make it look like it was the North Vietnamese shooting up this airport that they landed in wearing their uniforms. And so they did this mission. They went in there. They got in, I guess, at some point in the middle of the night. I don't remember the details. And they finished their mission. And then as they're rounding the aircraft to get back on the plane and get out of there, they hear the lower receivers on an automatic assault rifle click. And they're like, what the hell is that? And they turn around, and it was some of the other guys who didn't have real names, by the way, like us. And none of these guys had known who the other person was, by the way, when they joined up. So this is gives you an insight into how these things are formulated, so that there's less loyalty between them is the main point, I think. And so what was happening was some of their colleagues or comrades were being ordered to kill them to clean up the evidence. And the Asian members of the team were doing that to the Americans. So this is an American operation to kill Americans to eliminate evidence, just like they were doing in this movie.
Yes.
And they decided otherwise, and so they got out. At least he did. They were actually able to kill these intended assassins for them. And then they had to basically traipse through the jungles and try to get back to South Vietnam, and they were captured. And then I think two of his comrades were tortured to death. One of them had his skin peeled off while he was still alive. I mean, it's awful. I mean, this shit is awful. And this is what the governments are willing to do to their quote-unquote people in times of war. Now, it'd be one thing if the South Vietnamese were trying to, or the North Vietnamese were trying to invade America, but to put Americans into this maelstrom when really it was just a stupid civil war that the superpowers were having a jolly old time with, I think there'd be more of a case for having the government, U.S. government, make hard decisions like this. But I don't really think it's excusable when it's really, it's not our fight. But I think that's an illustrative example of a real case where this stuff happens. And everybody can debate, you know, whether it's right or wrong. I think it really comes down to, it depends. And I think that's what makes this movie kind of interesting to me, is that, is this right? I don't know. I mean, you look at what you're up against. It's like, well, they just obviously try to do the same thing to us, so do we do it to them? Mm-hmm. And what was also interesting in the movie was that they decided not to do it at a certain point.
Yep.
And then again, they tried to dispose of the evidence, at least in the movie, by killing the soldiers that they had trained. And that, again, was not officially explained. I don't know if that was actually what they were trying to do. But the Wikipedia page, for all that's worth, was saying that the soldiers, like you were saying, Borsley, were just frustrated that they were never going to get out of there and they were never going to be able to actually do their mission. And so it's just this, this is actually a real thing. A lot of special forces will get told at the last minute the mission's been called off for various strategic reasons, which, you know, you can sort of understand. I mean, you can't always do missions if the circumstances change. But what happens to these guys is they get all their gear on. They start, you know, playing whatever music is appropriate. I mean, Ride of the Valkyries was the South Vietnam Apocalypse Now type of music. I mean, that stuff is real. Like, soldiers will play that stuff. Yeah. To
get Fortune Sons begins playing in the background on loop.
Yeah, opening or beginning scene of Predator, you know, just playing the boombox, Jesse Ventura style. And then you're told, oh, by the way, guys, you got to go back home. Yeah. It's like you just had 10 cups of coffee and you're told to go to bed. I mean, it's that jarring to the system.
Having the Super Bowl team ramp them up and like, you know, they're about to go out into the field and then just saying, like, hey, Super Bowl canceled.
Yeah, coronavirus, sorry. Go back home. I mean, you know, tough shit, but it's like, it still sucks. And so this was going on for 3 years for these guys. And you can imagine how insane that would make somebody. And you're also told, oh, you can't get out until you finish your mission. So it really is kind of, if that's actually what happened, that can also explain maybe some of what motivated them, I guess. And
this is, the funny thing is, this movie came out in 2003. Which is an interesting context, because that was during the rule of Kim Dae-jung, who was Park Chung-hee's political rival, and he's been called the Korean Nelson Mandela because of the way basically Park Chung-hee and then the subsequent strongmen basically kept screwing with him and imprisoning him and kidnapping him and the like. And Kim Dae-jung would go on to win the Nobel Peace Prize and also pardon, forgive a lot of these people from this era. And this movie comes out, and it feels like this is, like, at the time that this movie came out, it was an attempt to basically examine that era, because that at the time, that Park Chung-hee era was all about building up this strong nation, so that they, bring a nation out of the ruins, bring a nation that was, like, fit, you know, at the bottom of the list, the fifth worst, like, developed country in the world at the time, and bringing it up to this incredible status. And now, like, going over all these things that were kept secret and bringing these things to light. But now in 2020, watching this, it actually even it becomes a symbol of hell, of what that term I refer to, which is Hell Joseon. And for people who don't know, Joseon refers to the name that that Korea was referred to throughout most of its history, the Joseon Dynasty, basically. So it's basically calling it Hell Korea. And among the youth in South Korea, there's this deep sense of hopelessness that South Korea has become a hellish society, and it's a result of kind of like they already weren't the most civic, patriotic people to begin with. That's become even more the case now, which is why you had those mass protests that took down Park Chung-hee's daughter Park Geun-hye in 2016-2017.
But I can understand maybe in the beginning phases of their republic post-war how it could their kids be complaining? It's one of the richest countries in the world.
Just to connect with the movie, part of the reason for this Hell Joseon thing is first you have the military thing, because South Korea's got that compulsory drafting system. But the thing is, like, draft dodging is extremely common in South Korea, especially among the upper class and they call them chaebol princes, like these men who are within the chaebol families. Chaebols are the giant mega corporations over. Yeah, and so there's yearly scandals of somebody from one of the families basically dodging their mandatory service. That's one of the reasons why class issues are so prevalent in South Korea. And that I was just wanted to connect that with this movie Show Me Dough, because that these are guys who they were pressed into the service, and because of where they came from, they were seen as expendable. And like, you can see that as an allegory as a metaphor for the drafting system that South Korea has, where it basically plucks these people, forces them into service, whereas other people get more leeway. They're able to shirk their duties constantly. That's why you have that quote from the sergeant later on, where he counters like that: when the nation's aims change, the nation has a responsibility to the people who they drafted for those aims. You can't keep this policy and then just be aimless. And then you can't be aimless with the people in it, because like they were put into that position for a specific purpose. You can't just leave them there. But as to your question about like what do they have to complain about, the youth in South Korea are experiencing similar problems that you're kind of seeing over here. The funny thing is that the way that they view it is that they see it as that South Korea is trying to emulate Western culture, and their working conditions and unemployment is getting worse and worse the more they try to emulate us. So they're beginning to like kind of get like that same kind of declassé kind of experience that's going on that happened to millennials in the United States. So that's one thing that's going into that. Also, Koreans are and so the margin for error to succeed in the country gets smaller and smaller because of how hyper competitive they are. I met a lot of ESL teachers when I worked for my company over there, and it's because the time period that I was over there, there was this huge surge in they call them hagwons, which are private cram schools. And the two most common ones over there, there's a hagwon for everything, but the two most common ones over there are math and English, because they're both required subjects, and they can be the hardest subjects to learn. Koreans are required to take English within, like, across their entire curriculum. So that's, and because the Hagwon system at the time was not really regulated, there was a lot of illegal shenanigans going on. You had this kind of black market English industry that was going on over there. I've actually even did a little bit like as a part-time gig as well myself. And they, but it creates this
so
obsessive study cramps.
Borzoi admits to being part of a black operation.
black market.
yeah. Sorry.
But it's, so they have this insane cram culture. And so Koreans, there's a lot of pressure on Korean students to basically always be studying. It's not uncommon to have students ostensibly be like in either their school or their Hagwon, and like the total time that, and then like the clubs that they have to do, like that they like they only get like four hours of sleep a night. And these are kids. These are kids that are being pushed to succeed, and you have that Confucianism that goes along with it. There's also that class culture that I had referred to, and because you're cramming all these people into these high population density areas with the with these farm villages be like being destroyed overnight, they're completely being like severed from their past almost immediately. And you know, like these are people who have relationships with their grandparents and great grandparents, and so they hear stories about how it used to be, and they are basically becoming culturally isolated from their own history because it's becoming a complete foreign nation to them now. That's where the where some of this Hell Joseon stuff comes from. And then there was a so part of the reason, this is not what brought down Park Geun-hye, but this didn't help. Park Geun-hye was the previous president, the daughter of Park Chung-hee. This is not what brought down her presidency, but this is what I would call the turning point. And this was a very important incident, was the sinking of the Suwon. Do you remember a couple years ago when this ferry?
Yeah.
So that was mostly kids on that, because there was part of like a I can't remember if it was a one school, if it was like a there was a class thing going on. Those were mostly kids. Those were mostly young people that were on there, and that sinking occurred because of if you've ever spent a considerable time in South Korea, you'll know that there's a lot of shirking of like responsibilities. They have similar problems as the Chinese do, and like that people maybe aren't doing the safety checks they're supposed to be doing. And they have this very Bali Bali culture, Bali Bali meaning hurry, hurry. So people tend to just kind of shrug things off. And there's this perception that's the older people that are constantly shrugging off things. And it's the young that are paying for that. And that sinking of the Suwon, because of that negligence, has become emblematic of that, because these kids were, due to negligence, were abandoned to die. And that was a horrific thing. You have these kids texting their parents their last, you know, like their pleas for help or their goodbyes. That's like that was a shockwave to South Korea, and I think that became emblematic of the whole Hell Joseon thing.
Yeah, it makes sense.
It was a messed up situation, and it's like it basically that was the point where Park Geun-hye's presidency was not going to be coming. Like there was no recovering for that, and then eventually the scandals hit, the protests increased, and she was impeached, and that was the end of the legacy of Park Chung-hee, mm-hmm. basically. And that's why it's interesting seeing Shil Mi-do in 2020 now, because whereas in 2003 it was kind of, I think, bringing these issues of the old regime to light and trying to like explore this theme of brotherhood and this lost childhood, it's become even more pronounced because there's this common sentiment among South Koreans that they're losing the sense of who they are because they're in this ruthless pursuit to try and emulate Western countries that are very successful.
It's funny. I guess we'll get into this more in mm-hmm. In our other show we're going to about to start up with, but I don't know why they feel compelled to copy the West so much. You know, I think a lot of their success is due to being Korean, frankly. I've always sort of viewed that about the Japanese. Maybe not the Chinese.
Koreans are a cop. I mean, I'll let you finish your point back and explain it to you. It's like the Koreans are a copy culture, basically.
Yeah, but why copy the West? I mean, I guess it does make some sense if you're historically aggrieved about the Japanese occupation. You wouldn't necessarily copy the Japanese, but Park was the exception.
He was a Japanophile.
Absolutely, and I think it paid off for them. So them talking about how, oh, the West is bad. I mean, oh, maybe just it's, do your own thing then. I don't know. You don't have to copy it. What are you copying? I mean, and the funny thing is they don't copy all of it. They copy, I think, the good stuff in some ways. And they obviously they have their own culture, but there's no morbidly obese Koreans. They're apparently some of the most superficially obsessive people on the planet. I know that I think the rate at which they do the epicanthic fold surgery, whatever it's called, for their eyes to make them look more Western, which I think is ridiculous, but they do that.
Korea is the capital of
women, and they are pretty obsessed with how they look, and so that is that's just Korean. I don't know if that's being Western, but they they just obsess about stuff.
Well, there's a number of reasons for it. So part of the thing that drives South Koreans is because they've historically been sandwiched between China and Japan. So they've always been under one sphere of influence or the other. And so that when you go over there, for example, you'll see like tons of statues of Yi Sun-shin. I think that's what his name was, the guy who the Korean admiral that basically repelled a Japanese invasion. So people who represent Korean independence are hailed as heroes there. Now, An Jung-gun is not hailed on the same level as historical heroes like Yi Sun-shin is. But and for people who don't know who An Jung-gun is, he was the Korean who assassinated Japan's Prime Minister Ito Hirabumi, and that was the impetus that the Japanese took to just annex Korea completely. There's other factors going on, but the An Jung-gun's assassination of Ito Hirabumi was a seminal event that basically set the tone for what Japanese and Korean relationships were going to be for the next 35 years. But with the Korean Japanese occupation of Korea. But as to Koreans are often driven by the sense that they have to assert their independence and they have to prove themselves to the world because they've constantly been under somebody's sphere of influence. It was actually a thing that drove Park Chung-hee as well, and why he wanted to make sure that they had independence in some sense from Japan, from the United States, which we're going to talk about on the other episode, so I'll say that. But it's also because Korea has been under Western influence a lot because of the missionaries, because Christianity became a large presence in South Korea. It's about 50% of the country is non-religious, and about 25, and these are just rough numbers, 25% of the country is Buddhist, and 25% of the country is some denomination of Christianity. But even among, despite those smaller numbers, like 25 to 30%, somewhere in that ballpark, Christians in Korea have always wielded a considerable influence because they built the foundation for the independent governments and the provisional governments and all that. And so because that gave them a lot of prestige and that gave them these connections to the West. That's one reason why they always tried to emulate the West, is because they all opened up those opportunities to them. The other reason why is that Koreans tend to have a copycat culture, where if they see something successful, they're going to do their best to copy that and create their own version of it. Which is how you end up with that whole Samsung situation and with the whole Samsung and Apple dispute. Yeah. That's emblematic of how they are. If they'll take.
Is that just Korean?
Everyone does it, but I guess it's funny and unique the way that Koreans tend to do it. It's why I've had people ask me, well, okay, well, are Koreans J-woke? And no, they're actually really not. And because there's a misconception, like they'll see North Korean propaganda, for instance, and maybe the North Koreans are a little bit more keen to it. I doubt it, though, because what they'll see is they'll see like propaganda where they'll draw like, and actually South Korea, you see this as well. Like Westerners are drawn with very pointy triangle noses frequently in cartoonish art. And I've seen people take that as like, well, they're drawing Jews. It's like, actually, they're not. Because the perception of us, and maybe I don't know where that perception came from. Maybe these people, maybe
Ron, right, Asians with this. Have flatter noses.
Yeah, and the slur for us is Kojangi, which when people are trying to run cover for Korean racism, or Korean bigotry, they try to say it means like fucking Yankee or fucking Westerner. No, it literally means big nose. Kojangi means big nose. They call us big noses. Mm. It's but where was I? Why did I? I'm trying to remember why I even brought that up with the whole. It's because there's a lot of mistaken perceptions of them. So like I've been asked like, oh well, Koreans Jay woke, and they're really not, but they are like they're woke in like weird ways.
Why would people expect them to know about Jews? That's so stupid. That's a dumb question. You know they live in a peninsula that is 99.9% Korean. Well, why would they know about anything like that?
They do know about Jews. And there's actually been some...
like they watch movies, but they don't interact with them.
There's actually some interest in the... I have to stress, like, this is not, like, a widespread thing. This is, like, a minor interest. There's some minor interest in religious Jews because of the religion that... of the presence that religion has had in Korea. And what they do is, like, they see... like, this is what I mean about the whole copy culture. They see this in a superficial way. They see Jews, they see that they're successful. They see that Jewish culture emphasizes learning, which Korean culture also emphasizes studying and learning very heavily. And they make that connection. It's like, okay, well, if Jews are being successful in that way, then, like, let's just imitate them. And like some Koreans have attempted to do that. Some Koreans have attempted to convert to Judaism to try and emulate. Like they'll look. They'll find a people who are successful, and they'll find. They'll try to. That's why
the 47th lost tribe of Israel. I swear to God, how many other people are going to claim to be Israelis?
So Koreans will superficially copy things. In kind of like a cargo cult way, thinking that it'll lead to the same success. Like they don't always. Now, many Koreans do like that. I think Park Chung-hee's success was like he understood like we have to get to the roots of how you build a successful nation. You have to do it on your own. But for Koreans who don't kind of follow that methodology, they'll take the most superficial way to copy something and try to copy that in order to emulate that success. But I think this is a good point to wrap up because we are pressed for time. Do you have any final kind of thoughts about this movie or recommendations or anything like that?
Well, I just think the most poignant aspect of the movie is just to whom do you dedicate your loyalty to? There's just many examples of different spheres of where an individual casts his allegiance throughout the movie. And obviously anyone who's lived a little bit knows that this is true in general, not just in Korean culture. But I think because of the hierarchical nature of Asian societies, it's always very interesting to me to see how they sort of formulate ways of explaining behavior or justifying behavior. But I would say the Western individualist notion is probably a little bit less strong in Asia. The group mentality is often viewed as an avenue towards, if not strength, at least security for the individual within a larger group. And I think that is shown in the special forces working together as a unit throughout the movie. They're taught to do that. You can also see how loyalty to superior officers, higher, people in the hierarchy is important. But at the same time, the loyalty doesn't always go the opposite direction. And then when that happens, you do have these mutinies. And so that's kind of interesting to me. Family loyalty is discussed a little bit, not really, doesn't come up very much. The loyalty to the nation, but also to the race, talking about North versus South. Well, we're all just the same people at the end of the day. Should we be fighting? Those kind of questions I thought were the most interesting part of the movie.
Yeah. In terms of recommendation, I signed off on all that. In terms of recommendation, if you want to see an interesting kind of like Korean, movie about brotherhood, I'd say watch it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the movie. I was actually a little bit surprised by how much they kind of like how far they went with like the brutality of it, because like, I didn't think they'd like show a rape on screen or like the of how severe like this kind of combat would go. But it's I overall enjoyed the film, and especially like if you want to kind of get a sense of like one of the most peculiar circumstances that's happened in Cold War history, it's definitely an interesting relic of that, and I recommend watching it. But one thing on the whole, just one little incidental thing about the whole individualism versus collectivism with Korean society. Yeah, Koreans are I hate using those terms, collectivism versus individualism, but it's to understand like how much they are that way with Koreans. Like you will get weird looks in Korea. Now, if you're a foreigner, they probably won't look at you as weirdly. But if like if you're a Korean, it is considered to be extremely weird in Korea, or just weird in general, that if you eat alone, it says something about you. If you're a person who eats alone, you're supposed to eat with other people.
Wait, are you talking about in public, or you can't have like a bowl of cereal by yourself? Like,
well, what does that mean? If you're in your home, I mean, like if you go out to, like, I guess I should say, if you go out to eat
in public,
if you go out to eat, it's like, you know, because like here we have this more individualized, animized.
I share that with the Koreans. I tell all my friends, I don't know why you go to restaurants by yourself. I would feel weird doing that, but I mean, I don't look badly at people who do that, on the other hand, but it's just personally, I feel like that is a social opportunity that should be used rather than. I don't have to get into my own personal psychology. I agree with it.
For Koreans, it reflects poorly upon you, basically, if you're out going to restaurants eating by yourself. They're not going to apply that as much to foreigners. They understand, like, we're foreigners, we're waygooking, so they understand that. But if you're a Korean and you are going to restaurants and eating alone, you're going to get looks, or at least you're going to get judgments, you know, silent judgments about it. But anyways, with that, check out Shilmido and definitely listen to Myth of the 20th Century, the Park Jung-hee episode when that drops, which usually you guys usually release your episodes on Wednesday. So we need to actually go head over to that right now. So with that, I'm going to push the pause button on this.